listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive, now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44321. Or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Before we get to today's Pathways show, I want to take a moment to thank everyone who's already supported KBOO's Summer Membership Drive. KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Together, we can keep the station alive and thriving. It's been 56 years and counting, but we need your support to continue bringing you the grassroots, independent, and one-of-a-kind shows from your community, like Pathways. Help us reach our $50,000 fundraising goal by making a donation today at kboo.fm/give. And we thank you for your support. Today, we're going to talk about attachment theory and particularly how it relates to different forms of relationship. And attachment theory has informed mainstream psychology, but most discussions focus on how we can cultivate it in the context of secure monogamous relationships. But what if, like more and more people, you're striving for secure, happy attachments with more than one partner? Today's guest breaks new ground by extending attachment theory into the realm of consensual non-monogamy. Our guest is Jessica Fern, author of the book, Polysecure, Attachment, Trauma, and Consensual Non-Monogamy. Jessica is a psychotherapist, public speaker, and trauma and relationship expert. In her international private practice, Jessica works with individuals, couples, and people in multiple partner relationships who want to be free of their reactive patterns, cultural conditioning, insecure attachment styles, and past traumas. Jessica holds a master's degree in conflict analysis and resolution. Well, hello, Jessica, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, so we're going to talk about monogamy and consensual non-monogamy. And, you know, I think it's very interesting to observe that monogamy is a fairly recent norm. And, you know, it's like only about, you know, since the agricultural revolution, as far as we know. I mean, history only goes back 5,000 years. So, but in any case, it's relatively new in the history of Homo sapiens. And now it's just like completely dominates the way that humans think about intimate relationships. And there's this word that you talk about in your book, mononormativity, and and how attachment theory as we know it is highly mononormative. What does mononormativity mean?
Yeah, that means that we assume or we hold monogamy as the standard, as what is considered normal, natural, and right. And it can be a very invisible force, right? We meet people and we assume they are monogamous and have one partner, or we invite them to an event with a plus one, not a plus two or three.
Right, right.
Right, or our legal systems are set up for the monogamous couple. Our homes are built in certain ways for a nuclear monogamous family. So it really permeates in many different ways.
And attachment theory, as we know, it is highly mononormative. And so it's about having a secure attachment. So let's talk about attachment theory. I thought the first half of your book was brilliant. You know, it's like, it was the best exposition of attachment theory that I've read, and I've read a lot of it, and we've had quite a few shows about it.
Thank you.
Let's just kind of like summarize attachment theory. You've got secure attachment, and you've got three different forms of insecure attachment.
Exactly, which are avoidant, anxious, and what's considered disorganized.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people assume, they believe that monogamy is not only the morally superior way to practice partnership, but it's also the only way to get secure attachment. And your book takes issue with that, thus the title,
Yes.
Polysecure. What does it mean? What does secure attachment mean?
Yeah, secure, well, it means many things. But in its essence, it means feeling safe and secure with our partners, trusting in their ability to show up, to be available, to be responsive, to be attuned to us, not 100% of the time.
Right.
And that we are showing up in that way too, that we're a safe person and we're also an encouraging, supportive person in partnership. And I always like to say, you know, we can have a secure attachment. We might still feel insecure in certain moments, but someone who's in a secure attachment will bring that up. Let's talk about it
Right.
instead of act it out by either withdrawing or kind of trying to control or getting clingy, things like that.
Okay, so they say in most statistics say that approximately half the population had a secure attachment with their primary caretaker, which 90% of the time is the mother, and half the population didn't have what they call the technical term good enough mothering.
Right.
It's,
Good enough parenting. Yeah.
yeah, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it's got to
Right.
be good enough. And what makes it good enough? Tell us what the criteria is.
Yeah. It's sort of some of the things I just said of being available, being responsive, being attuned, being warm emotionally, right? So we often think of just the physical needs being met, and that's what kids need, and that's it's much more beyond that. It's the psychological and emotional needs.
Right. So the mother is available. There's not a situation of neglect or abuse or anything like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so the theory, attachment theory, when it pertains to adult relationships, posits that the type of attachment that you had with your mother or your primary caretaker is going to permeate your intimate relationships for the rest of your life. And that there's two ways you can go. You can be anxious, in which case you're always seeking connection, or you can be avoidant, where you solve the problem of intimacy by avoiding it altogether, or as much as you can. And so I'm just, how do adult romantic attachment bonds differ from the child-parent relationship?
Yeah, well, the most obvious one is it's bidirectional instead of unidirectional. It's reciprocal. So a parent or a caretaker and a child, it's the adult that's more in the giving role. And they can have attachment needs met, of course, through their children, but it's more about them giving the safe and secure attachment to the child and the child's receiving that.
Right,
But
so
in
it's
an adult relationship, it's reciprocal. We are giving and we're also relying on. So there's more of an interdependence on each other. It's not a dependent relationship.
well, is there any point in trying to even have an intimate partnership of any kind if you're stuck in an insecure attachment style?
Of course, because we can heal through that relationship.
Okay, so there's this
Yeah.
thing called earned attachment. And do you think that
Exactly.
earned attach, I mean earned secure,
Yeah.
is that possible for anyone?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is statistically research, you know, proven that if you've had an insecure childhood with your caretakers, you can have an earned secure attachment in adulthood. Also, sometimes our attachment gets really jostled through adult experiences like divorce or death or betrayal, and we can then have been secure and be insecure and then come back to security again. Yeah, so there's, you know, some people take it, I think, a little too far. There is a lot of work we do need to do alone on our attachment healing, but attachment ruptures happened in relationships, so we need to heal them also in relationship.
Right. You know, as you point out in the book, and I found this fascinating, that it takes some time to establish a secure attachment, even for a baby. You know, you see in the book, and I don't know what your sources were for this, but that it takes an infant 7 months to feel
around 7 months,
to feel secure in its attachment with its mother, and it in an adult intimate partnership, it takes 2 years to, you know, of course, these are rough approximations, but I found that to be very interesting. You know, sort of like that was a wake up call for me and say, oh, I want a secure attachment with a partner and I want it now.
Right. We all want it now. Exactly.
Right. But it's going to take a couple years. And that's sort of like, oh, puts things in perspective.
Absolutely. And my theory too, just through my practice, is that we actually can't, I don't think we can really settle into secure attachment until the new relationship hormones, the NRE, the honeymoon hormones, have abated. Because I think as wonderful as that is, it can mask and create even distortions in our attachment system. And you'll see people that once the hormones shift, they actually start showing up in a different attachment style.
Now, I read a book on relationships a long time ago. It's out of print. It was called A Conscious Person's Guide to Relationships. And one of the chapters was entitled, Falling in Love is Not a Good Basis for Involvement.
Right.
And yet that's exactly what everybody does. And so I think people think that, well, if we have a secure attachment, we're going to be in love forever. There's going to be this NRE feeling, new relationship energy forever.
Right. It doesn't work that way. And I say something similar frequently, you know, several times a week in my sessions, I'll say, love is important, but it's not sufficient for a healthy long-term relationship. Like, we need a lot more than just the feeling of falling in love.
Right. Yeah. Love is a very big word. It's got at least 20 definitions. And, you know, and you point out that for a lot of people, monogamy can serve as a stand-in for secure attachment.
Exactly.
Because it's obviously more, you know, reliable than polyamory.
Well, it's not more reliable. Or how are you defining reliable?
Well,
right? If we look at cheating statistics and divorce statistics, we go, wow, monogamy is quite a mess. Right? It's not very reliable. But from a structural perspective of having structural, societal, and cultural support, yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
You point out, and you, this is, I think, a quote. CNM, okay, first of all, CNM, that stands for consensual non-monogamy, which is like a more precise way of defining polyamory. You say CNM is inherently insecure, unlike the built-in security that apparently comes from being monogamous. But then on the other hand, you say, despite what people presume, CNM relationships have been found to have greater levels of trust and lower levels of jealousy than monogamous ones.
Exactly.
I found that to be ironically interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is, because in non-monogamy, we can't rely on the structure of monogamy to support us. So we have to work a bit harder and more intentionally to create secure emotional bonds with people. So there's just a lot more intention, a lot more communication, a lot more negotiation even of what are we doing? Why are we doing it? How are we doing it? A lot of things that just monogamous couples assume and don't even discuss.
So what do you see happening culturally or in society? Do you see CNM becoming more and more prevalent, more and more mainstream?
Yes. Yeah, it still has a way to go, but you know, we're seeing like there's a reality dating show about it. So when you start to see that level of of culture and society presenting it, right, whether it's accurate or not, that says something.
Yeah. Now you say that CNM can either be an orientation or a lifestyle choice. Can you unpack that?
Yeah. And this was done from qualitative research I did of just interviewing people and asking them, monogamous people and non-monogamous people, like, why did you come to this? And what I found is that it's a spectrum. And on one end, we have monogamy. On the other, we have non-monogamy. And people on both ends of those spectrums say the same exact thing. They say, this is just who I am. This is not a choice I made. I didn't choose to be this way. I feel wired this way. It feels what's like most me, most natural. I feel born this way. That's the things they say. And so they're describing it as an orientation, the same way people would describe their sexual orientation. They didn't choose to be attracted to this person or that person, they just are. But then there was a lot of people in the middle that said, yeah, I'm not necessarily wired one way or the other. I could do either or. And sometimes I do this, and sometimes I do that, and it depends on who I'm with or the life phase that I'm in. And so some people call that like polyfluidity, or some people call it ambiamorous. Oh, is another phrase that's a newer phrase that people are using. Yeah.
Okay. So if it's an orientation, that's not really a willful choice that people are making. But if it's a lifestyle, that is a choice. And why do people choose that lifestyle if it's not just about their fear of intimacy?
Yeah, well, they choose that. What do you mean, fear of intimacy?
Well, avoidantly insecure people, I think, are fearful of intimacy. That's why they're avoiding it.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're equating the lifestyle with avoidance?
No. I'm saying the lifestyle choice is not about that. But what right. is it about?
Yeah. For some people, it's about diversity of experience. For some people, that is a romantic-based or needs-based diversity. People are starting to really question the idea of mononormativity, that one person could even meet your entire needs. For some people, it is about sexual exploration and having more sexual diversity.
But isn't that bad? I mean, you know, sex is sacred, right? I mean,
it can be sacred with more than one person, too.
I love it. That sounds great.
Yeah. Right. And that's a whole variety and spectrum as well. For some people, it is sacred with everyone they're with, even if it's more than one person. For some people, it's more about expressing different sides of themselves or different sexual styles. And it can be more casual. And we've really kind of pathologized casual sex. And, you know, that's one aspect of non-monogamy, not the only one at all, but it's embracing sex positivity.
Right.
Yeah.
How much do you think successful CNM depends upon having a secure attachment within oneself?
I think it's a lot. Yeah. What happens is, opening up or going through a transition, if you've already been non-monogamous, where you're maybe de-escalating a relationship or changing the level of hierarchy, it will expose how little of a secure attachment within that you might have. And so it really is a catalyst for a lot of personal growth.
I love that you go into that in the book too. You're helping people understand that and that they can develop a secure attachment with them, within themselves.
Exactly.
You know, I think that's part of the challenge for a lot of people. It's like, you know, how can I love myself when my mother didn't love me, or when other people, you know, it's like I we need to have this. We have this psychological need for external validation. A lot of us, and without that, you know, we don't feel good about ourselves.
Yeah, right. So it takes effort as an adult to say, how do I feel good about myself?
Right.
And relationships are a piece of that, but that relationship with self is such an important thing that often gets overlooked in some of the other attachment stuff.
Now, you were married and you've had children, and you were monogamous, you know, probably most of your life. How did you discover polyamory for yourself? Because my understanding from your story is that you discovered it within, you know, and for yourself, and then realized that a lot of your, through your clients, you know, your clients would tell your psychotherapist and people would talk about. So anyway, how did you make that transition? That's very interesting.
Yeah, and it had different iterations. Like, since I was 14, I realized I wasn't monogamous, but there was no language for it.
Right.
No one was really talking about that, you know, we'd have some group makeout sessions or something like that, or it seemed like the three of us were kind of dating or had feelings for each other, right? But then, yes, when I got married, I did get into an exclusive monogamous marriage.
Right.
And
Why did you do
even,
that? Just because
yeah, that's right.
mononormativity?
We kind of went with the mononormativity. But we weren't traditional. Like, we had things in our relationship that other maybe monogamous couples wouldn't. Like, my husband then could have a female best friend and even sleep over her house, and that was okay, which usually that would like not be allowed. Right? Like, we had a lot of emotional intimacy with a lot of different people, not just each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we did say, you know, we would discuss opening up at some point if that's what, you know, was on the table. But it was through clients coming to me and talking about it, and then me realizing I don't know enough about this professionally, so I started reading about it, and then I identified, like, oh, this is me.
Uh-huh. And so, yeah. But what was your insecure attachment style? There's three types, right? There's avoidant, there's anxious, and then there's fearful avoidant, which
yeah,
is kind of like going both ways.
It goes both ways. Yeah. Mine would be more of the like fearful withdrawn.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know for me, you know, that I've had an insecure attachment style growing up due to my family system, and that I tend to be avoidant if somebody is like, you know, really after me.
Yeah.
And I tend to be anxious in the
if
opposite.
They're not. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Life
yeah,
is
well,
beautiful.
And you're right. You're talking about the dynamic too. It's not just that, oh, I'm stuck in my own attachment style. It's that, oh, my attachment expression will change depending on who I'm with and what their style is.
Wait,
so it's
you said
not a rigid thing.
You said something like that about yourself too in the book, where you say you were, I think you said you were fearful of avoidant or something, but now you consider yourself secure. You earned secure.
Earned secure, for sure. And even with my husband at the time, I felt very secure with him. So it felt easier for me to open up because
uh-huh.
I felt so secure with him. Whereas he would have previously said he was secure, and through us opening up, he realized he was extremely anxious. And that anxiousness appeared in our dynamic like never before. We'd never encountered it between him and I in that way.
Because you had the structure of monogamy.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And as we changed the structure, his attachment shifted. Whereas mine initially felt more secure, but then in the people I was dating, I would see, you know, these patterns of more anxiety than I had sometimes experienced, or, you know, this withdrawing pattern.
Mm-hmm. What is the impact of having polyamorous parents on children?
Yeah, I would recommend anyone curious about this, go look at Elizabeth Sheff's research. She is the first one, maybe the only, to do longitudinal studies on polyamorous families and polyamorous kids. I think she did like a 25-year longitudinal study. It's pretty incredible. And her research says the kids are all right. That's the basic summary, is that the kids actually have a lot of benefit of having more attachment figures, more kind of positive adult relationships in their life.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now people think that polyamory is going to, one of the big challenges is going to be jealousy.
Yes.
As if it's not a big challenge in monogamy.
Good point, right.
But, you know, I heard it said that jealousy in the polyamorous universe is, it happens, but it's more of a like, considered like an annoyance instead of like a, you know, a relationship extinction event. And I find that to be interesting. So in other words, what is jealousy about? It's about boundaries, right? It's about possessiveness. But tell me, break down jealousy for me, and
Yeah, it's about so many things, and I think it's just as prevalent in non-monogamous relationships. I don't think it's just an annoyance. Sometimes it does take a relationship down, or it gets really blown out of proportion or blown into proportion, right? But the polyamorous universe embraces it as this is a part of the territory, and we're going to work with it. We're not going to be afraid of it. We're not going to avoid it. We're going to see it as an important messenger. It's pointing to something. And that's how I approach it, that it's either a pointing to something in ourself that we need to work on. So if I'm feeling jealous, is it because I'm insecure about something within myself that I'm not looking at, right? Or I'm comparing myself to the other partner? Or is it something that's going on in the relationship? It's not really my own stuff, but my relationship, my partner isn't following through with agreements. They're breaking agreements. Or they've made promises to me and they're not following through with that. It can happen a lot where if a new person comes into someone's life, they're taking more time and attention from pre-existing partners. That can bring up jealousy, right? That's not just possessiveness. It's saying, oh, I'm used to a certain level of attachment needs being met, and now they're not being met at that level, right? So it's actually an attachment protest that can be quite healthy, if we know how to work with it.
Well, I just looked at the clock. I can't believe that our time is just about up. And in fact, we've just got a minute left, and I'd like to invite you to impart some words of closing wisdom for our conversation today.
Yeah, I think just the takeaway is that yes, people can have multiple secure relationships with multiple partners. It's possible. Just as we can say that we had more than one caregiver usually, and not just even mom and dad or dad and mom, but often we have attachment figures like grandparents and siblings that are very significant. Well, we can, and multiple children that we might have, we can also have that with multiple lovers.
I have loved this conversation, and I'd like to have more of them with you. It's sort of like, how many partners can you be secure with? It's questions like that that we don't have
Yeah.
time to explore today. But before we go, I want to tell our listeners about your website, because
Yes.
they can go and they can find out about your work, and it's www.jessicafern.com. Jessica Fern. All one word, FERN.com. And thank you, Jessica. There's so much
My
we could explore.
Yeah, thank you. I know we just started.
I know, it's amazing. Now, for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, don't worry, you can play and/or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Jessica Fern, author of the book Polysecure: Attachment, Trauma, and Consensual Non-Monogamy. And I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. Or perhaps you subscribe to the podcast version for free, which you can find at divination.com, that's DiviNation.com, as well as looking up Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where if you like our conversation, you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe, and please feel free to forward a link to your friends. Before I close the show today, remember that we are in the final week of our KBOO summer drive. You can donate by going to www.kboo.fm/give. Our members make KBOO possible, so please make a contribution today. Your donation is tax deductible, but more importantly, it feels good to be a contributor and not just a consumer. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for listening to volunteer-powered, community-supported KBOO Portland. Well, this is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. And thanks again to Jessica Fern and to all you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Miss Nana No, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Join KBOO around the campfire. Become a member during Camp KBOO's Summer Drive, taking place now through June 29th.